Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. Today's sponsor is Cassidy Gerber, who wrote to me and told me something I was really glad to hear. She wrote, "I just started listening to your podcast a couple of months ago, and I really love it. I started down the path towards veganism almost a year ago now after reading Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma. I just thought I'd let you know that, since you've mentioned you don't have the highest opinion of his work, so even though he killed a pig, he helped to create at least one new vegan, not that it matters much to the pig he killed." That was Cassidy's words. Anyway, I just wanted to thank you for your podcast. I really appreciate the topics you cover. I'm not very good at defending the vegan lifestyle. I get so frustrated when I'm talking to someone about why I'm vegan and explaining to them that I don't think an animal should have to suffer because I feel like eating chicken nuggets. Being constantly surrounded by people eager to challenge my values, it can be hard not to feel like a silly emotional girl at times. Sometimes I don't know how to respond to people, and I even feel like logically their criticism of my beliefs makes sense. Listening to your podcast has been just what I needed to feel more secure in my lifestyle. Hearing your well-researched and beautifully constructed show keeps all the reasons I've decided to become vegan fresh in my mind and makes me feel like I'm part of a community of people with the same beliefs. It's amazing how tenuous we can all be made to feel about this lifestyle. It's just amazing the power others can have over us, especially about this issue. You're doing a great job, Cassidy. I know it can be challenging and exhausting at times, but I encourage you to find strength and hope where you can, and definitely stay close to those who make you feel supported. When you're close to those who make you feel unsupported, try and understand that it really has nothing to do with you. It's just their stuff, and in your presence, just your mere presence as a vegan, is bringing up loads of stuff for them that's painful for them to face. It has nothing to do with you. So thank you again for your sponsorship and your kind words. I'm so glad the podcast is helping. If you'd like to sponsor this podcast, we would appreciate it very much. Just visit CompassionateCooks.com and click on Support Our Podcast. Little goodies in the form of our recipes are in it for you. So thank you for whatever you can do to help us spread the word and create a safe haven for those who are awakened in a world that seems to be sleeping. So hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode. The structure for today's episode is such that I'll read an essay from someone else, someone other than myself. The essays I've chosen thus far are ones that I have been very moved by and that I think are written beautifully. So I want to share them with you. And the reason this particular essay that I'm going to read means so much to me is because it speaks to the very, very fundamental relationship between a mother and her offspring. Humans have claimed so much over non-human animals. We deny them everything that's natural to them. We manipulate them, we mutilate them, we enslave them, and deny them their most basic desires. I mean, we deny mothers their own babies, for goodness sake. I don't know how much more fundamental you can get than that. We deny them the most basic desire of wanting to nurse their babies and groom them and protect them. This is especially the case in our exploitation of cows, who are kept for their milk. And you can also see this in the exploitation of female horses. You may have heard of this. Mares are female horses who are kept pregnant to produce a particular hormone that's used in the production of a product called Premarin. There's also lots of other products by the same company, and they're basically estrogen replacement therapies for postmenopausal women, human women, and they're using the urine of mares to make this product. And there are many ways to produce this with synthetic materials, which are just as effective. But instead, Wyeth Eyerst, the company that manufactures Premarin, uses the urine of pregnant mares. And they're not just collecting this urine in a humane way, okay? The animals are confined. They live their entire lives penned in tiny stalls, and they're unable to turn around or meaningfully lie down, and they're deprived of water because it would dilute their urine, and they're repeatedly impregnated, and they're continuously connected to plumbing, collecting the urine. And when they can no longer produce adequately, they're slaughtered. And the babies of those mares are either put in stalls themselves or slaughtered. So the word Premarin, just so you know, it's an acronym. And it basically comes from the words pregnant mare's urine, P-R-E, pregnant mare's, M-A-R, in Premarin, I-N, for urine. So I don't think they really come out on their website and talk about where the stuff comes from and how they make Premarin. It's hidden there in the word for their product that they sell. And there's absolutely no way to justify this stuff. You know, humans can claim no moral superiority over other animals when we do this kind of thing to them willingly and knowingly, particularly when there's plenty of options out there so that we don't have to do this. How can we say that we're the most advanced species on earth when we continually choose profits over principles? How can we say that we're the most advanced species on earth when we use and abuse animals when alternatives are available? We don't have to do this. We cannot make the higher claim. We just can't. And we certainly don't have the corner on motherhood. Despite our desperate attempt to remove ourselves from our non-human brethren, we are animals, and we have a lot more animal instincts than we like to admit. Every woman will tell you that her drive to protect her young, her own offspring, her babies, is what she would call, and we all call, the maternal instinct. And any right-minded person would agree that if this is instinct we're talking about, it exists in all animals. If we know that to be true and real, then how can we so arrogantly deny animals their desire to fulfill that very basic, fierce, real, powerful instinct, that maternal instinct that all animals have, including humans? I wonder if we're able to do this because we eventually come to call that maternal instinct in humans love. And if we call it love in non-human animals, we're anthropomorphizing, right? I mean, it's the same thing. So whatever you want to call it, it's the same thing. It's the drive to protect their young. It's love. It's love in humans. It's love in non-human animals. But we don't want to call it love. We want to accuse ourselves of being anthropomorphic so that we can continually separate ourselves from the beasts, from the animals. The one thing that every individual should be able to claim is the protection of his or her own body. To violate someone's body is the most egregious crime we can commit. And we do it again and again and again to non-human animals. We use males for their sperm to impregnate females. We kill male chicks at egg hatcheries in horrific ways as soon as they're born because they have no purpose in the egg industry. We crate and then kill the male calves who were born to dairy calves. Sometimes we don't even go as far as crating them. We just kill them right away. And each one of these things is horrible and cruel, but no animal suffers like the female who endures pregnancy after pregnancy. Cows, by the way, are pregnant as long as humans, 9 months, and horses are pregnant for 11 months, only to have her baby dragged away from her. Ask any farmer what the experience is like taking a calf away from his or her mother. Every instinct of the mother is in full gear as she tries desperately to take her baby back, but she's powerless to do so. Can you imagine that frustration, that anger, that fear, that sadness? She's powerless because the humans have already decided against this. They will take her baby, and they do. She loses every time. I truly think that no farmed animal suffers more than a cow being kept for her milk. Not only are her babies taken away and then killed, of course, but she endures pregnancy after pregnancy, painful pregnancy, mastitis is common, and she is just exploited, hooked up to machines several times a day to get her milk that she can't give her baby. It's just such arrogance and utter cruelty on the part of humans. Susie Costin, who is the director of Farm Sanctuary's New York shelter, she's the mama to all the babies at the sanctuary, and she has many, many, many wonderful stories to tell about all these babies, including one about Bertha and Robin. In 2004, Farm Sanctuary was part of a rescue that seized 26 cattle from a cruelty case in Pennsylvania. There were four calves and 22 cows. They had been rescued from a situation where they were forced to endure standing in manure that was 3 to 3.5 feet deep. They had no food, no water. Many of them were emaciated, and many of the animals had to be euthanized on the spot because of the severity of their suffering. Farm Sanctuary was able to take this 26 of these animals, and also find loving homes, loving vegan homes for many of them. And they kept the rest. In both cases, they will be protected the rest of their lives, whether they're living at these wonderful homes or on the farm. And when the cattle first arrived, some of the cows were pregnant. So Farm Sanctuary had some unexpected births at the shelter. And one of the cows was Bertha, who after giving birth didn't want to nurse her baby. She kept pushing him away and just rejected him. And the staff learned very quickly the reason why. Her mastitis was so bad that it was really, really painful for her to nurse. Mastitis is a painful infection of the udders that affects 1 in 4 dairy cows, and it manifests itself as an infected, sometimes hugely, just grotesquely, hugely enlarged udder. And though Bertha was being kept on a beef operation, she wasn't on a dairy farm, she had no doubt been used for many years as a breeding cow and had many, many babies taken away from her over the years to just be killed for steak or prime rib. She most likely developed her mastitis from the filth that she was forced to live in before she was rescued. So anyway, Bertha couldn't nurse her baby. It was too painful. Her baby was named Robin, but she would still watch the staff very carefully when they bottle fed him, and she made sure he was okay. And then one day, when her mastitis was cleared up and she felt no pain, to the surprise and delight of the staff, they watched her nurse Robin for the first time. It was a very emotional day for everybody as they watched her able to feed her baby herself for the first time. And they have photos of this, grooming him and tending to him and nursing him for the first time. It's just so incredible. 3 years later, Robin is now 2,000 pounds, and whenever he gets scared, whenever he gets nervous, he runs over to his mother and nurses. He's 3 years old and 2,000 pounds. He was being raised for beef. That's why he's so large. He was bred to grow very large, but obviously they're bred to grow large, but they would never get that big. In the industry, they're not killed at 3 years. I mean, they're killed at like 6 months to a year. So they do it so that it's economical. They grow really quickly, so they're at what they call slaughter weight when they're still very young. But this is just an idea of how quickly they make all of these animals grow, not just through hormones. This is not just through hormones they give them during their lives. This is how they're breeding these animals to grow very quickly, in a short time, so they can kill them as quickly as possible. So he, at 3 years old, is 2,000 pounds. And the first thing this 2,000-pound old steer does when he's nervous or scared is run to his mama so he can nurse her. I mean, it's just so basic, and this is what we deny these animals. And this bond goes both ways. Sadly, Bertha has cancer and she's dying. She's about 20 years old now. Cattle can live up to 25 years. But again, we kill them from anywhere from 1 day old, when they're either, you know, male calves at a dairy farm, or, you know, they're either killed that day, they're called Bob Veal, or they're chained up for 16 weeks and they're called, you know, regular veal, or they're killed at 4 to 5 years when they're dairy calves. Cattle are killed, like I said, 6 months to a year if they're being raised for beef. They're all babies. All these are babies. The dairy cows live that long, having been exploited for that many years, but they're killed at 4 or 5. The point is they could live up to 25 years. So she's 20, and she has to be brought to the hospital occasionally. Well, one time when they brought her there, this may have been the first time, they brought her there. She was so upset that she wouldn't eat. She was really depressed and she wouldn't eat. And so in response, they decided to bring Robin, her son, to the hospital to be with his mom. And this is no small task, I assure you. And once they brought Robin, Bertha was fine. She just needed to be by her son. She needed her son there. She needed to know he was okay. This is the bond they have. This is the bond of mothers and their children. I don't care what species you are. So when we hear things from small dairy or beef farmers, when they say say things like they really care about their cows, I'm sorry, but there is a very clear, unmistakable cognitive dissonance going on there, because you can't say you care about these animals and then impregnate them and willfully take away their babies. When we do this, we're causing great pain for these mothers and for the babies, you know, for their short lives. The mothers grieve. They grieve, and of course they go on, though in some cases animals do die of grief, just like humans do, but they never forget. These animals never forget. And you can check out a podcast episode called Acts of Forgiveness if you want more about that. These animals don't forget this. So this story I'm about to read was written several years ago by a woman named Lois Flynn, who, as far as I can gather, had a small sanctuary for animals. So here is Lois Flynn's story about Dancer. Dancer came to me when she was 6, going on 7. For the first 6 years of her life, she had had no name, just a number, part of a large dairy herd. She was about 7 months pregnant when she came to me, a Jersey Springer, her great bag swinging, heavy with milk from her last calf, long gone, long dead, long veal. Not long ago, like all the rest, her fifth baby had been taken from her, barely a day old, a little boy. You see them at the auctions in crates out in front of the dairies, pathetic little fellows, their navels oftentimes still wet from their birthing, their little empty bellies unfed, their soft baby voices lowing for their frantic mothers, once more confined to the hydra suck of the god-awful machines draining their milk into the vast vats and thence to the maws of humankind. 5, perhaps 6 such babies Dancer had borne. From the time she was physically able to have babies, she had carried and birthed a baby a year. For 279 days each year, she carried her baby curled high in her belly, close to her heart, while the machines sucked and sucked at her teats, sucking the milk of the baby before. One day of each year she spent giving birth, 24 hours to nurse her baby, nuzzling and washing and nurturing the tiny creature with her rich colostrum. Then they would come, as they always came, the soul-dead tenders of the Hydra machines, and kick and curse her back and seize her baby and drag it away, boys to the vealers, girls to be raised for the same servitude as their mother. Ah, the dreadful, deadful, moo-moaning bellow of the two, such a keening knell of awful anguish that surely must move a stone to pity, to no avail. One day, shortly after her last baby, Dancer slipped and fell on the wet concrete ramp as she and the other mothers were being herded to the milking. Somehow, one of the others trod on her teat, and it was ripped away as she struggled to rise, or so the story is told. Perhaps it was mashed by the machine or hacked away by one of the tenders. Who knows how she came to lose a teat, but certain it is that a three-teated cow is no use to the machines. So she was sent to the auction, kicked and cussed into the truck, kicked and cussed off the truck, kicked and cussed thirsty and hungry into the ring for the bidding to start, like all her babies before her. And she stood there with her painful swollen bag, dripping milk and blood from her torn teat, shaking her great head at her tormentors. And she bellowed, as her babies had bellowed, as all of the mothers bellowed, and the babies there bellowed. Moo moan, such a keening knell of awful anguish that surely must move a stone to pity. I bought Dancer. Not only did I buy her, I paid her auction price, a bargain to be sure, because Dancer now carried a calf. And this calf she was going to get to keep forever. On that I was bound and determined. As her time grew closer, I obsessively began counting days, looking up gestation tables in the manual again and again. Always it said the same, 279 days for a Jersey. I counted the days off on the calendar, August 1st. Every time it came up, August 1st, again and again. I counted forward, I counted backward, August 1st. While I fretted, Dancer wandered the range with her friends, grazing the grass. She sat with her circle in the shade by the creek, chewing her cud. Morning and night the cows came to the barn for their hay and their grain and their treats, apples, carrots, bananas, grapes. A week before August 1st, I prepared Dancer's stall. Was 16 by 32 large enough? Was it too large? Too small? When should I confine her? Should I confine her? Dancer herself settled the confinement question. When I tried to lock her in, she bellowed with such anguish that I immediately turned her loose with her friends. I decided to go with the advice of my rancher friends who ran cattle wild on the range. Keep an eye on her from a distance, they said. She's had calves before. She'll know what to do. She'll pick her spot. And so Dancer dropped her calf right on schedule. At dusk, in the cool of the evening on August 1st, she picked her spot, as the ranchers foretold, a clean spot, surrounded by a fierce stand of thigh-high star thistle, bristling with one-inch thorns, situated at the southwest corner of a 40-acre paddock, in which all the water and shade was at the northwest end. In the gathering dark from my distant perch, I barely discerned the ease and grace of the birth, the competent way Dancer cleaned her calf, licking and loving her tiny form, nudging her carefully to her feet for her first tentative steps and flop back down. Then she nudged her back up again, stronger steps this time, though still a comedy walk, guiding her back along her side to her dripping bag, crooning softly to her, reaching out. Oops. She loses her balance and sits back down. Patiently, she starts the whole process again and again, till she fastens on and sucks for maybe a minute. Then she rests. Then up again. Another minute-long suck. Then a little later, a stronger minute, caught in flashlight glimpses. Dancer has done it. She has had her calf, a fine, healthy calf, mother and baby doing well. But now I had a real problem. Suddenly it struck me. Dancer and baby are at one end of the field, surrounded by a thicket of thorns. Water and shade and sweet grass are at the other end of the field. The barn is even farther away, and August 2nd is forecast to be a scorcher, 110 degrees in the shade. I did not have a pickup. All I had was a 1983 much-abused Toyota four-wheel drive wagon. 9 a.m. came, and Dancer was still in her star thistle fortress. In retrospect, the story is funny. It was serious at the time. Knowing Dancer's history, the whole notion of picking up and moving her calf was anathema to me. How do we explain to them that the sometimes horrible things we do to them, we do out of love, in their best interest, to the very best of our soul-searching perceptions? Anyone who has trapped and taken a feral cat to the vet knows exactly the torn feelings. That was how I approached Dancer, torn. I knew that picking up her calf would bring back all the nightmares of all her other calves, the dreadful desolation. I knew it would also be but momentary. The sun was already burning down. She and her calf had to move from her thorn fortress into the shade. I drove to within 20 feet of her and the calf and brought her grain. She would have none of it. She tossed her head and pawed the ground and did her fighting bull act. A long time ago, perhaps as a child growing up around my father's greyhounds and running free around relatives' farms, in with the pigs and the cows and the bull, and with older sisters who were legendary horsewomen, I had learned that unless they consider you something good to eat, non-human animals simply do not want to hurt you. They will posture and threaten, even when they are acting to protect themselves. They generally choose to use the minimum force necessary. They mostly want to get away. So I did not consider myself brave when I approached Dancer and picked up her baby. I was much more worried about her distress than any threat to me. Moreover, I was in more danger from the star thistle scratching through my jeans and stabbing through my sneakers. I picked up her baby and carried her to the car, placing her carefully in the rear compartment. I was too preoccupied to appreciate how perfectly exquisite she was, with her great ears and great eyes, soft nose she wrinkled at my smell, tiny hooves still encased in her birth slippers. Most of all, I remember her perfect trust, her obvious belief in a benevolent world that would continue to love her as her mother loved her. How could anyone ever hurt such a creature? How can we let the hurt continue? How can we stop it? I guess one calf at a time, one mind at a time, one calf's story reaching many minds, one by one. Slowly, I started to drive toward the shade. The baby quieted, relaxed in the back, seemingly enjoying the jaunt. Not so Dancer. She ran frantically round and round, searching for her baby, bellowing the awful bellow that will tear my heart for eternity. But she did not seem to know to follow the car. The baby now started to fret. I promptly drove back to Dancer and opened up the rear door to show her the baby. Once more, I tried to drive away. Once more, I drove back. The sun was going for its personal best in scorchers. I lifted the baby from the car and started out across the field with her in my arms. This worked. Dancer followed, dancing around, making soft noises to the baby, then gently butting me along to speed up the process that was getting heavier and heavier at every step. Bang! Another butt from Dancer. Stagger a few more steps. Bang again. So it went for the whole miserable 1,000 feet. Every rotten, miserable inch of it with star thistle stuck in my sneakers and jeans. The baby was a girl. Dancer nursed her until she was almost 18 months old. Of course, they are still together here at the sanctuary. Dancer no longer becomes frantic at the sight of cattle trucks coming up on the property bringing new arrivals. She dances with her very grown-up baby and the other cows under the light of the moon. Sometimes they let me dance with them, whirling and swirling, such light-footed giants in tune with the earth and the beauty of being. A very wise person once wrote, "In this age, there is always enmity against animals, and therefore the poor creatures are always anxious. The reaction of the poor animals is being forced on human society, and therefore there is always the strain of cold or hot war between men, individually, collectively, or nationally. The earth affords a lavish supply of riches, of innocent foods, and offers banquets that involve no bloodshed or slaughter. As long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other." A very wise man wrote that. Sounds like it could have been written yesterday. It's attributed to Pythagoras, who lived somewhere around 500 BC. When will we get it? What are we waiting for? On behalf of the billions of animals who are right at this moment at the mercy of humans, and on behalf of the humans who right now have the capacity to show mercy, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.